How Animals Talk to Each Other from the Book of Knowledge, edited by Arthur Mee and Holland Thompson, Ph.D. When we think of animals talking to one another, none of us expects them to have a set language such as our own. We know that they do communicate with one another, but it is not by means of words such as we use. How do we know, then, that they talk? We judge by results. Horse talks to horse and does his best to make himself understood by man. Dog talks to dog and, in 100 different ways, seeks to speak to us. Cats have their own language. The wild beasts of the forest, of the plain, and of the mountain have their speech. The birds are gifted with a considerable language, and the insects have, perhaps, the most varied language of all. Few of us know even the ABC of the animal language, and this story will not pretend to teach it. We shall instead think over things which show that animals do communicate with one another, and we shall try to understand how some of them do so. With few exceptions, all the higher animals make use of their voices. But we are not to suppose that the speech of animals is confined to the sounds which we ourselves are able to interpret. There are other ways of communicating than by the voice. Let us suppose that some person from a far land, say an Eskimo, were to discover two deaf and dumb boys talking upon their fingers. Would that Eskimo imagine that a conversation was in progress between the two? The method would be strange, and not to be understood by this Eskimo, who could never have heard of such a thing as the deaf and dumb alphabet. There are, open to the animals, ways of speech quite as wonderful as that employed by our skillful deaf and dumb boys and girls. Let us start at the top of the animal tree and think of the monkeys. We know that they have means of communicating one with another. We all remember the story of Jenny, the orangutan in London, who did such clever things under the instruction of her friend and her trainer, the keeper. One day she went farther from her cage than she had meant her to go, and he pretended to be cross with her. She instantly ran up to him to make friends, put her arms around his neck, kissed him, and whispered to him till she believed herself to be forgiven. He did not understand what she was whispering, as doubtless one of her own species would. A very different experience of ape language befell Brehm, the great German traveler and naturalist. He came upon a troop of baboons and two bold dogs, which he had with him, went in pursuit. The baboons ran away, leaving behind, however, a baby baboon, which Brehm hoped the dogs would catch for him. But as the dogs drew near, there was a loud outcry among the baboons. And while the rest yelled their battle cry to frighten the dogs, a big old baboon came quietly but quickly down the rocks, snatched the little one away almost from the jaws of the dogs, put it in a place of safety, and kept guard until it had got up to the rest. 2 days afterwards, Brehm met the same troop. Again the apes raised their battle cry. Brehm discharged his gun at them. The females fled in haste behind rocks with the young ones, while the big males, roaring and barking, sprang upon the edges of rock and then deliberately rolled big stones down upon Brehm and his companions. The baboons all acted under the command of their leader, and one actually climbed a tree with a stone in his arms, that he might have a better and higher position from which to throw his missile. Many such cases have been recorded, so that there is no chance of a mistake. Take an even more notable example. Here the animals were a party of baboons at the Cape of Good Hope. They had stolen some clothes from barracks, so Lieutenant Ship sent a squad of soldiers to recover the articles. The baboons made for some caverns, which the soldiers tried to prevent them from reaching. But the baboons were too quick. They posted 50 of their number to guard the way to the caverns, and the others distributed themselves like soldiers at various posts and hurled down great stones on the soldiers. The leader was an old gray-headed baboon, which the soldiers knew quite well, for it had often paid visits, friendly visits, to the barracks. He was the general, and the soldiers could hear him issuing his orders to the rest while the others obeyed him, as soldiers obey their officers. Here the English soldiers had to retreat before the apes, as Brehm and his friends had had to do, to retreat from ape soldiers who acted like human beings, upon the spoken instructions of their skilled commander. It is not easy to study the language of such terrible animals as lions and tigers. We know that the lion roars like thunder to terrify his prey or to challenge other lions to battle. But when the male lion talks to the lioness, he uses gentle language and will purr to the lady of his love like the great cat that he is. The speech of the tiger is not more easy to describe, but we may see by a story what happens when the tiger does speak. A few years ago, a man who was resting after a day's hunting in India suddenly felt himself crushed to the ground, and on coming to his senses found that a great tiger was carrying him away in her mouth. She carried him about a mile and a half, then put him down. His left shoulder was broken, and he dared not to move, though he still managed to clutch his gun in his right hand. The tigress now raised her head and gave a long, soft cry. The answer came from a jungle nearby, and two tiger cubs, her babies, came scuttling up. They were terribly frightened when they saw a man lying at their mother's feet. But she cried softly and purred to them, and taking him up in her mouth, gently shook him and tossed him about from paw to paw as a cat tosses a mouse. She was telling them by speech and by action to come and eat him. After much persuasion of this sort, they approached and began with their baby teeth to tear at his legs, until, rolling over onto his side, he managed to level his gun and shot the tigress through the heart. Tame tigers meow to call the keepers to them, and purr with pleasure when they are answered. They have a certain cry when they want water and another kind of cry for food. If we notice, a half a dozen boys put their heads together, then separate, and all set to work, we imagine that they have agreed upon some plan. A similar conclusion is reached, then, when we see animals do the same sort of thing. Two foxes were seen descending a narrow, rocky valley. They stopped at the bottom, put their heads together, and seemed to be coming to some agreement. One of the foxes now lay down in some bushes, while the other returned up the little valley. Presently came down a hare, running as fast as it could, with the fox hard after it. The hare shot past the concealed fox, which darted out a second too late, and so missed the hare. The second fox came up immediately, stopped when it reached the first, made an angry sound, expressing disappointment, then attacked the bungler, which had spoiled the ambush that they had planned together. There is no doubt that cats try to speak to their masters and mistresses. Many cats have warned human friends of fires which have broken out in the night. Extraordinary evidence of intelligence was given by a cat in a suburb one September night in 1906. Its mistress was aroused from sleep by the cat meowing and scratching her. This behavior was extraordinary in so affectionate a cat, so the mistress sat up in bed and looked about her. She at once discovered the cause of the animal's anxiety. Her husband had been seized with a fit and was lying desperately ill, and the cat had wanted to call the wife's attention to the matter. A clergyman not long ago saw a young cat, which had been absent from home for a week, return to the garden by way of the wall. Its mother lay on the lawn, and the kitten, which looked fat and happy after its long absence, went up to her. She got up, and they put their heads together as if talking. After a minute or so, the kitten and its mother bounded on to the wall, and off they went together. They were absent from their homes for more than a week, then returned in the best of condition. Without doubt, the younger cat, on first returning to the lawn, had told its mother of some great find, and she had gone away with it to share its good luck. Wolves make very clever arrangements before setting out to hunt deer. They come up to a place in a body, hold a sort of conference, then divide, and each one takes up a place for itself. One wolf will then approach the deer and drive it in a certain direction. The deer is too fleet to be caught like this, but up jumps a second untired wolf and drives it a little farther. A third wolf will chase it toward another ambush, and a fourth will continue the chase, always working toward where another wolf is concealed, until finally one of the hidden hunters is able to dash out and make the capture. All the other wolves then come up and share the food, thus one. Naturally, we expect more than the average amount of intelligence in the elephant, and we are not disappointed. It has a voice like a clarion for communicating messages to far-off companions. How this acts, we know from Mr. W.T. Hornaday, who a few years ago was in India to get elephants for the New York Zoological Park. An attack was made upon a herd of wild elephants, as the herd was divided into two parts. One half went north while the other half fled south. The hunter's camp lay between the two sections. About bedtime, says Mr. Hornaday, the elephants began signaling to each other by trumpeting. The sounds were just such as a bugler would sound were he calling troops to assemble. One herd called, and the others answered, and it soon became clear to the hunters that the two herds were advancing from different directions to unite. And the two herds did unite, guided the one to the other by the signals. The trumpet call, says the hunter, was a regular helloa signal, and quite different from the tului blast which elephants sound when feeding. But there is a silent language which elephants employ. We must remember that in time of drought, many pools at which animals drink dry up, so that a great number of wild beasts are driven top the pools which still contain water. Hence enemies are brought together, and experience has taught them all that men are likely to lie in wait at these spots to shoot them. One dark night in summer, an English officer climbed a high tree overlooking one of these watering places to watch for a herd of elephants coming to drink. For 2 hours he waited without detecting a sign of life. Then, very quietly, a huge elephant, such as the herds always follow, stalked out of the wood and walked very cautiously toward the pool, halting near it and remaining motionless, listening intently. Feeling satisfied at last, he returned to the wood and came back accompanied by 5 other elephants. They all marched slowly to the water, and the leader posted the 5 as sentinels in 5 different positions near the pool. Then once more he went back to the wood, and this time brought out the whole herd. 80 elephants trooped down to the water to quench their thirst, but not until their leader had come out to see if all were safe. They had waited to receive instructions from him, and now they and he and the 5 sentinels drank their fill. The officer, who watched in wonder, felt convinced that the whole plan had been carefully arranged in advance, and that the whole herd acted entirely under the control and direction of the splendid beast which led. It was a triumph for silent language. It is after elephants are tamed, however, that we are able to see some of the most wonderful things that they do. 2 tame elephants had to climb with their loads up so steep a place in the mountains that their drivers placed tree trunks as steps for them. The first elephant to go did not like the way at all and complained with loud cries to the one waiting below. The latter watched with the greatest interest and could not keep still, but was moving about all the time as if trying to help its comrade, just as we see men moving their hands and feet when watching a gymnastic display. At last, the first one reached the top, and the turn of the second came. He was just as nervous as the other. The one at the top waited anxiously, and as soon as he could, he put out his trunk, curled it round that of the other elephant, and pulled the latter safely up. And then what a scene of joy there was between the two. They embraced each other with their long trunks and stood face to face for a long time, as if whispering congratulations. A word now for the conversation of the pigsty. Let us remember that by nature, the pig is one of the cleanest and most intelligent of animals. It is only the cruel manner in which men neglect the pig which makes this animal's habits so unpleasant. There was a famous pig in the New Forest, which was taught to find and bring back game, which its master shot. This pig had a numerous family of little ones, and she noticed that one by one, these were disappearing while she was out hunting with her master. The little ones were being taken and eaten by their owners. One night, the big old mother pig was missed from her home, and men set out in search of her. They found her and the remainder of her family on the verge of the forest. She was talking busily away to them in the best of pig language and driving them to a place of safety in the woods, away from the sty from which so many of their brothers and sisters had gone to the roasting spit in their mother's absence. How whales talk, we do not know. But we do know that the mother whale is a devoted parent who will fight to the death for her little ones. Brave, too, are the seals. The male seal will defend his family until he is struck dead. The mother does not wait. She calls her children with a voice like that of a bleating sheep, and away they shuffle to the sea. She talks to them in this way when danger does not threaten, and it is at the call of her voice that they go to the sea to learn to swim when they are babies. We must all have noticed that rats and mice have some way of talking. If a rat should discover a new source of food supply tonight, by tomorrow night he will have brought a dozen friends with him to share, and these in turn will bring dozens more. But do we ever think of the frog as a talker? He must talk pretty well. If we walk quietly up to a frog's pond on a warm night in spring or early summer, we hear frogs talking. Make a sound, and there will be heard one loud commanding croak, then a series of flops, and after that, perfect silence. The leader of the frogs has sounded the danger signal, and all the rest have popped down under water. Here is an instance of communication of a different kind. A gentleman who lives in a country house was alone in his house for some time a summer or two ago. At the bottom of his garden runs a meadow in which frogs live. One of these frogs made its way into his garden and lived in his rhubarb bed. He did not like frogs, but some of his visitors did, so he let his frog remain where it was, free to come and go in the meadow or in his garden. One evening, as the gas was lighted in his house, what should he see on the doorstep but the frog from the meadow and the rhubarb bed? The weather was very chilly, although the time was summer, so there was a fire in the sitting room. Master Frog, hopping through the doorway, entered the sitting room, looked about, then hopped toward the fire and squatted down, blinking comfortably at the cheery blaze. The gentleman was amazed at its imprudence, but let it remain for an hour or so, and then he gently put it out of doors and went to bed. Next night, the frog was there again, so he felt bound to feed it, for mere hospitality's sake. He knew nothing about the diet of frogs, so after puzzling his brains, he put down some powdered sugar. And, astounding to relate, the frog ate it, every speck of it. After staying its hour, it was put outside. There had never up to this time been more than one frog at a time in that garden, so far as was known. But the very next night, after the supper of sugar, the frog came back, accompanied by its mate. Both creatures received sugar that night, and they enjoyed it. Every night for the next 3 weeks, the two frogs appeared at the same time at the house, were admitted, and were given their supper of sugar. And then, at the end of the 3rd week, the kind-hearted gentleman had the misfortune to tread on one of the frogs and kill it. The other one went out as usual, but was never seen afterwards. It could not understand that its mate had been killed by accident, and it could not go again to the place where its mate had come by its death. From wild animals, we come back to tame creatures. Anyone who has had donkeys in his neighborhood need not be told that these animals talk to each other. There is a cheeky little Shetland pony who has had his portrait in the Children's Encyclopedia who knows how to talk to a donkey. The pony spends an hour or two every day in a meadow adjoining his stable, and sometimes a donkey is to be seen in the field next to it. The pony, on being turned into the field, first takes a gallop all around, then canters up to the iron fence and neighs. This call brings up the donkey to the other side of the fence, and the pony waits for the donkey to put his head between the railings and gently nibble his neck. Then he returns the compliment by nibbling the neck of the donkey. That is an exchange of service which horses and donkeys love. This pony has set speeches with which he summons people to his stable. He has a shrill neigh which announces that, according to his appetite, it is time the groom went to feed him. He has a low whinny which expresses his pleasure when he hears a familiar footfall approaching his stable. If he wants to come out, he knocks at the door with his front feet. Should he by any means be short of water, he will tap at his bucket with one of his hooves until somebody supplies him. But what of the dog and his speech? That he understands much that we say, all of us who have kept dogs, no. A fine example is furnished by a gentleman who was talking to a Scots shepherd of the latter's dog. The shepherd, to show the intelligence of the animal, said in the middle of a sentence about something else, and said it in a low voice without looking at the dog. "I'm thinking, sir, the cows and the potatoes." The dog instantly leapt up, sprang through the window, and clambered up on the turf roof of the hut to get a good view. Not finding the cow in the potato garden, it went to the cowshed, saw the cow there, then returned. The trick was repeated, and again the dog darted off with similar results. Presently the shepherd said for the third time, "The cow's in the potatoes, sir." But this time the dog merely got up, showed his teeth as if in a smile, growled at his master, then curled himself up before the fire, and refused to go out. There is a good deal of language in the bark and in the whine of a dog. The dog can almost speak to us with his eyes, with the twists and jerks and shrugs of his body. But how do dogs talk to one another? Perhaps at times their thoughts are transferred without sounded words from dog's brain to dog's brain, as we transmit telegrams without telegraph wires. It is certain that nothing could be heard when the following incident took place. A puppy, nearly full grown, was lying on a garden wall while his father lay below. Suddenly the puppy spied an enemy, a big dog, running down the road. The puppy jumped down and went to his father. They put their heads together and seemed to be talking for a moment or so. Then both leapt onto the wall, jumped onto the road, and set off as hard as their legs would carry them after the big dog. Alone, neither was a match for the big animal. Together, they could thrash him, and they would have done so had not their master, after following them for some distance, called them back. More wonderful than this, for the reason that it was in a better cause, was the action of a spaniel which was found lame by a kind doctor. He took it home and cured it and let it go. A few months later, the spaniel returned, quite well, but bringing with it another dog which was lame. With pitiful looks and whines, it seemed to beg the good doctor to give its friend the kind of treatment it had received itself. Lest we should think this is too wonderful for belief, let us recall an incident which happened at a London hospital. Three dogs marched in there one day. Two of them were terriers, belonging to a well-known bookseller. These two were all right, but between them they helped into the hospital a big collie dog, which had been injured. The terriers lived near the hospital, and their master's explanation is that, frequently seeing injured people taken there, they had come to the conclusion that a place which was good for suffering men and women and children must be good for suffering dogs. But how eloquently they must have talked to persuade the injured collie to let them take him to the hospital. The End. Read by Leonidas for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.